Blog Talk Radio.
Listeners, this is Military Monday, and I am your host, John Gresham, and it is a beautiful day, a beautiful winter day here in Fairfax, Virginia. Temperature's just around freezing, but the sun is shining, and best of all, starting tomorrow, we're going to see 50s. Yes, 50-something temperatures to go ahead and hopefully melt these massive 12-foot-tall piles of stacked snow. And to give us the hope that there might be hope that there will be a spring. That said, today we're going to talk about the business of journalism. And specifically, we're going to talk about investigative journalism. There's a lot of us out here who write the news. I regularly write for several publishers. I write books from time to time. But I'm pretty much a dilettante compared to certain types of journalists, and today you're going to meet one of them. Investigative journalism really got its start with the work of people like Drew Pearson of the LA Times, Jack Anderson, who was his protege, Woodward and Bernstein, of course, of the Washington Post, among others. There is, however, a new generation of investigative journalists. They're media savvy, all across the realm of social and other media. They're internet savvy, and more importantly, they're technically savvy about the subjects that they write about. And while some may think that this goes ahead and somehow makes the job of investigative journalism a little easier, as you're going to find today, all it does is sometimes make it more dangerous. Now, there's a lot of people out there who go and claim to be investigative journalists, and I'm not going to deride anybody who's willing to go into a greasy spoon and count cockroaches and rat feces. Yeah, that's important to do. That's a public health thing. But how often do we actually talk about someone who investigates something involving their own government and their own military who is threatened with harassment, who is threatened with being charged and incarcerated for what they've done? What do we call these people? Well, in the world of journalism, we usually call them Pulitzer Prize or Emmy Award winners. But what if you're a magazine writer? Because the Pulitzers and the Emmys cover broadcast, news journalism, daily stuff. What about the people who are writing for technical journals or publications that are magazines? What kind of award do they get? Well, normally there's something called the Neal Award that covers a number of categories, but buried in the Neal Awards is an occasional award. And this occasional award, called the Timothy White Award, is given occasionally to editors who have to do extraordinary things and endure extraordinary hardships, harassment, and even threats of incarceration to get their stories out. I am proud to introduce the man you're about to meet. He has just been announced as the 2013 Timothy White Award winner, and his name is Mike Fabey. Mike, are you there?
I'm here. Good afternoon, John.
Mike is the naval editor at a rather well-known technical journal called Aviation Week and Space Technology. And if you are in the Washington area, we all know Aviation Leak, which has been out there for longer than we've been alive. And Mike, tell us about your job. What does it mean to be the naval editor at Aviation Week?
Well, I'm kind of the oddball, the kind of stepchild there. While everyone else concentrates on things that fly, I concentrate most on things that are on or just above or below the water. So anything that kind of floats, goes submerged or fires from such things, that's sort of where my bailiwick is.
And how does one become the naval editor at Aviation Week? Where are you from originally, and what did you do to get here?
You only have an hour show, so I'm not sure where to start with that. But
Reader's Digest version, Mike.
The Reader's Digest version is no worries there. I had gotten my start, just the short part of this, through mostly mainstream journalism. I worked for a bunch of small dailies and things on that nature. Then I broke through with something called the Journal of Commerce, where I started covering steamship lines and the waterfront. From there, I was actually able to develop that along the lines of doing some international reporting, living in Brazil for a while and covering international trade, and again, the waterfront and chasing modern-day pirates down in the Americas and things like that. When I got back to the States, I wound up working at Newport News Daily Press, where I was covering the waterfront, and as part of that, Newport News Shipbuilding, which, of course, got me to Navy Shipbuilding. And from there, I went to Spanmore News, where I was covering more ground kind of things with the Third ID and stuff like that. But I came back, worked for T4 Defense News, and then eventually over to Aviation Week.
Now, you're a normal guy, raised, I believe you said, in the Philadelphia area, got a wife and kids. Why in the God's name would you want to go and get yourself embroiled in a story where you might go to jail? Was it a conscious decision, or did it just kind of evolve and one day all of a sudden someone was threatening you?
What's the mindset of someone
who suddenly finds themselves in that kind of conundrum as a journalist?
Well, it starts off as kind of just an offshoot of normal everyday reporting. Essentially, as the naval editor, one of the most important programs that we're covering right now is something called the Littoral Combat Ship. This ship is the new Navy idea of going coastal taking on a bunch of different kinds of threats. It's been a problem, like, program for a long time. And so I was basically doing some of the daily due diligence on covering that program, and then we wound up with some rather nasty information about things were going to program, the folks at the Navy and the contractors were kind of saying that what we had wasn't true. So it just kind of escalated from there. We were put in a situation of proving what we had was true, and not only because that's part of our job, but it became pretty clear and apparent to us that Sarah's life could really be at stake here if what we found out to be the case was not correct.
Well, before we get to the he said, she said, yo mama phase of the story, let's back up a little bit and explain the program, the Littoral Combat Ship, or LCS program, to our listeners. And, Mike, let's start back at the beginning in the late 90s and early 21st century up at the Naval War College with a guy by the name of Admiral Zabrowski, who was the commandant up there. Tell the story of how LCS kind of was born up there.
Yeah, he had this idea of what became known as the Street Fighter concept. In this concept, you'd have a swarm of relatively small but also relatively lethal boats that could kind of go away and pave the way, act independently to create paths near the coastal areas open up areas that were kind of denied to our bigger ships and things like that. But in his plan, this Street Fighter was really going to be, back alley brawler of the seas type of thing. It would, be small but carry quite a punch and be a force to be reckoned with themselves, especially when they operate swarms. So that was the general idea from the beginning, relatively low cost, but at the same time would still carry enough of it could take care of itself, in other words.
Now, there was the usual debate over this concept in places like the Naval War College Review and Naval Institute Proceedings. the naval world is, if nothing else, civilized as it argues over what it thinks it needs. But when you finally make up your mind as a nation and as a Navy that you want to build a new kind of ship, that decision takes the form of a requirement document, and that requirement document lays out specifications for various features, performance parameters, and other things of the ship. Now, in the case of LCS, there was the unusual development that this was handled not at the Naval Sea Systems Command particularly, but directly in the office of then Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral Vern Clark. Talk about what happened in there and how this neat little idea of a little street fighter ship became much bigger and much more, period.
Yeah, I mean, Clark took the basic concept of the idea, and he the one requirement they put in there that really just kind of threw everything off balance was an incredible need for speed, and everything was going to be sacrificed from that. And then after that, they kind of just took it and said, okay, these ships are going to be really cheap. We're talking on an order of cheapness that was, given the need for speed they were talking about and looking for, was never, ever going to be realized. So they had the speed.
How fast are we talking about? What was the original specified speed for a littoral combat ship?
Right now, they'd like that thing to go 50 knots. And I can tell you that when I've been on board, it's approached fast to that, but that's right around the threshold is 40+. I mean, it's classified beyond that, but you know it has to go at least 40. You know, it's going to be 40+ knots. But they're really pushing it to go as close to 50 or should like go above, but as close to 50 as possible.
Now, it's worth noting to our listeners when we talk about a nautical mile. A nautical mile is somewhat longer than a statute mile. About 6,000 feet as opposed to about 5,200 feet for a statute mile. So going 40 knots or 50 knots is really fast. In fact, if you can make 50 knots, you can be given a speeding ticket on more than a few country roads. And American fleet units like destroyers and cruisers normally have a target speed somewhere around 30 knots, correct?
Right. The idea was to send these things out to an area ahead of everyone else. They would sprint out there, have these missionized packages, and then they would clear it away. But the problem with what they did was they sent them out there and did not give them they took away some of that lethalness that they were originally meant to have. So they were out ahead of everyone else, but the inability to defend themselves. They had to be under the umbrella of a destroyer, for example, even though they were supposed to be ahead of the destroyer. It was a very odd, backwards way of thinking.
Example, whereas a destroyer or frigate might have a 3 or a 5-inch gun, this had a 57-millimeter gun.
Right. And
the only air defense was essentially a self-defense system called RAM that's used as a, you know, point defense, last-ditch defense system for U.S. ships. And originally, there were no anti-ship missiles organic to the ship, and there still aren't.
Yep. This thing is just, on one hand, what the Navy now says is that, well, we're going to take greater risk than we had before, and what they'll also say is, and don't forget, this is supposed to be, you know, work in tandem or part of the rest of the battle group, which we ask, well, how do you send out ahead of it? It's going to be under the defense umbrella of it. Everybody says, well, the con ops are being worked out.
So there is this rather odd requirement that it be very fast and yet have very little organic armament. There was shaping to help make it stealthy. But there was also a couple of odd requirements. Talk about the manning.
Well, here's the thing. They want what they, in order to keep it at the weight they felt they would need to make it really fast, they had, you know, it was their minds, they wanted to keep the manning as low as possible. Just more people, the more of everything you had, the more water you have to bring, the more laundry you do, I mean, everything like that, more supplies you have to bring. So they said, basically, we're going to do a manning of 40. Now, everyone I've talked to who's associated with the program, manning was pretty much a back-of-the-napkin figure. There really wasn't a whole bunch of analysis that was put into it. They said, yeah, that's what we think we're going to need. And so a 40-person crew is going to be out there on something that's basically close to about 3,000 tons. I mean, you know, we're talking about, and well, there's no, like, ship out there, but for example, you're talking somewhat significantly less than even a frigate, which is the closest thing in size. That it's amazing. As part of that, they did put more automated systems aboard, but nowhere near the number of automated systems that would be required. We can talk later about that, but the result was they actually had to increase the number of automated systems as well as increase the manning because they found out it was just way too low.
Mind you, so you have a ship that has now grown to the size of an Oliver Hazard Perry-class frigate, but only has about a third of the personnel aboard and, again, is underarmed. There's also, now, we should say that you might ask, well, what can you do with a ship like this? And the answer is mission modules. Explain the concept of mission modules as they are associated with a littoral combat ship.
The littoral combat ships are essentially meant to accomplish three missions when they're quote-unquote missionized. And as you said, these are both mission models. What it is that these are containers, and they're packed with the gear, the equipment that you're going to need, as well as from the berthing, that you know you're going to need for different types of the missions. And the main missions for this are surface warfare, mine counter warfare, and anti-submarine warfare. So those are.
So in other words, a mission module is a bunch of Connex containers loaded into the stern of this ship, and that includes berthing, habitability, and other things, as well as the actual equipment, weapons, drones, whatever, remotes, that are going to allow the LCS to do that particular mission.
Right. You know, for example, there's very little changes to the ship. You know, for surface warfare, they put a pair of 30s on top side. And what they do is they take a crane and lower it in, they bolt it on, and then when it's done that mission, they'll take it off. Now, they're supposed to be able to do these, you know, almost like a Lego block kind of concept with these containers and do it within 72 hours. Well, you know, that's as long as there's no storms, no high winds or whatever. No one's quite figured out exactly how fast they can do it when you add in everything. But the Navy says, oh, but what we don't have to do is we don't have to take the ship in to make a whole bunch of, you know, metal changes that require, you know, anywhere from, you know, a few months to even a year of overhaul.
So there's the theory and there's the reality, and this all goes into this requirement. Now, there's a classic statement in the engineering world where we say a horse, you know, a camel is a thoroughbred horse designed by a committee. How much was the LCS requirement, the specifications, compromised by the fact that it had to be all things to all people in the surface Navy of the United States?
Well, it's not only has been, but is a continues to be type of thing. I mean, usually you have a ship, you have, the, as you said from the beginning, a basic set of requirements, and then you build ship requirements and develop this, you know, concept of operations around all that. And then you develop the ship, you know, forward from that. And in the case of LCS, what they did was they had a basic idea plan to do. They went to start building a ship. They found they couldn't build the ship to meet the very specifications they meant, so they start changing some of those specs. And then at the same time, people got involved and said, wait a minute, you don't even have the defense on the ship that we really want, so you ain't even changed some of the specifications that way. So then they had to change the requirements to match the specifications they were building to. Then once they started getting the ship out there, they found they couldn't operate the ship to some of the very con-ops they expected. So as they said, they're still doing the con-ops. So you've got right now a bunch of different admirals who've had and command officers who have been taking the ship, moving around, changing the con-ops to it. They're still right now incorporating changes along some of the later ships they found in the early ships because of some of the problems they found. So it's you had the first ship. I mean, this ship was supposed to be a $250 million venture, and the first ship is very right now close, somewhere upwards of $700 million, and the second ship is right around, it's a little bit less than that, and that's what they have right now. They think they're going to have a production model, you know, out there right around halfway through a 10-ship build. And that production model is somewhere, you know, between $350 and $400 million.
Okay, so it comes out of the Office of the Chief of Naval Operations, and let's say it right now. We have had more than one senior Navy officer whose names shall be protected here. But there's been more than one senior Navy officer who has said it was a lousy requirement, and it's still a lousy requirement, right?
Mm-hmm. There is definitely no consensus of agreement within the Navy about this ship at the highest levels.
Okay, so nevertheless, the United States Navy decides we're going to build littoral combat ships. In fact, we're going to build a lot of them. What is the actual requirement for LCS? How many do they still want to build today?
Well, they right now, I mean, they still want 50. 52. They still want 52. The directive down from OSD is at 32, although that directive is not set in stone. And there's an awful lot of negotiating going back and forth, especially some changes at the highest levels of OSD right now. So we'll see what.
And we'll get to that a little later. So
right.
The Department of the Navy gets the requirement, and the Naval Sea Systems Command runs a competition. And there's like six major contractors, all who want to build littoral combat ship. The plan is to go and take the best two designs out of these six and build one or two of theirs, evaluate them, and theoretically do a down select. Who winds up winning?
Both of them. the two top ones wound up both getting block contracts to build their own versions of this. The most of the people that I've talked to have been involved in shipbuilding programs say this makes no sense. And it's even created problems within the surface warfare community because the folks who they want to go board these ships, you know, some upcoming officers, don't know which variant could wind up being or, you know, which one's the best one. It's a logistical nightmare in many situations because they have different systems on different ships. And these ships were designed and built by completely different companies. It's been a challenge, to say the least, on Navy side. But the Navy officials argue that because there are supposed to be so many of each version that they've picked, that in and of itself will create the kind of logistical train that will make economic sense for the years.
Yes, and hope and change is a great thing. Now, who were the actual winners? Name the corporate teams that actually won the right to build the two different LCS designs.
The very first lead ship, now known as the Freedom Variant or Freedom Version, or in many cases Freedom Class, because it's so different, is a team led by Lockheed Martin. They have Marinette as their shipyard out in Wisconsin. The other team is a kind of a true partnership of General Dynamics and Austal USA. Austal USA is from the Australian company Austal. And their variant is based on a kind of an all-aluminum ocean-going Faraday they've got down from that part of the world. And if you want, I'll go into now the differences in the two ships, or if you want to hold that off, we can hold that off.
Go ahead and just lay down the basics.
Okay.
And it's worth noting, both ships have the same basic armament sensor package. In other words, they both have the 57-millimeter Bofors gun. They both have the RAM launcher up on top for close-in air defense. They have a small smattering of 50-caliber machine guns. They both have hangars capable of operating two H-60 airframes. But now talk about what's different on them.
If you were to look at the Freedom class, I mean, it almost looks, some ways, resembles a kind of a compact cruiser in this way. It's got a steel monohull on the bottom, an aluminum deckhouse up top. And the basic combat system based on that is Combat S, which is based on the Lockheed Aegis combat system. So that's, you know, that's essentially, it looks pretty much in many ways like a traditional Navy ship. The folks at GD Austin went completely different, and their ship is a Trimaran, all aluminum, with an amazing amount of hangar space and upper deck landing area and takeoff area for all kinds of aircraft. It just looks like nothing like else in the Navy fleet right now.
Very stealthy, very fast. With some very different and very positive seakeeping qualities.
Was it last part? What qualities?
Well, and the Trimaran, yes, gives them some very different and positive seakeeping capabilities for a ship that size.
That's what they argue. It certainly is. Thus far, I haven't seen any complaints about any of the seakeeping areas on that variant.
Whereas, of course, the Lockheed variant, which the Freedom, which is ironically based on an upsized cigarette racing boat, while it's very fast, it is what we call a semi-waterplaning, and that is the faster it goes, the higher up the hull gets in the water, theoretically reducing the drag of the hull and actually getting faster as it moves more quickly.
As a concept, and having been aboard that ship at top speed, it plays out that is one fast ship.
Okay, so these are the two winning designs, the Freedom and the Independence. Now, it's worth noting here that Freedom was contracted a year to 18 months in lead of Independence. So the Freedom has been the ship that the Navy has the most experience in working with and operating, and in fact has just completed a deployment, whereas Independence has primarily been a test ship for one of the mission modules devoted to mine hunting and has not really gone operational yet, correct?
That's right. That's exactly right. The Navy feels that the mine countermeasures module is the most difficult to develop, and that they are giving the biggest amount of attention to that right now. And as a result of that, they've just basically said Independence, that the LCS-2 is just going to be working on that and doing pretty much nothing else for the immediate future.
All right. Before we move on, if any of our listeners want to call in and ask any questions or offer any comments, please feel free. Our call-in number is area code 347-945-7246. Again, that call-in number is 347-945-7246, and we'll try and catch you and get you on the air. Now, these are all high-minded objectives and goals for this very large class of ships. I mean, this is going to be the biggest class of warships in the U.S. Navy, in theory, by the middle of the century. But right out of the box, there were problems fabricating these ships, particularly with the USS Freedom, correct?
Yes. Absolutely. I mean, they've had stop and goes on that ship while it was still in the yard, in fact. But the real issues that came, you know, that sort of, you know, came to light was after the ship start, you know, coming not only out of the yard, but start to sail around off the East Coast and down around to San Diego through the Panama Canal. And when we wound up in San Diego, there were obviously some issues aboard in terms of cracking. There was at least one hole in the crack, but the superstructure was pretty well cracked up, and there were also problems with saltwater intrusion that led to one of the engines being replaced and things of that nature.
And there was corrosion as well, which normally we think, well, if you're going to build warships to operate in saltwater, corrosion's something you worry about, except Freedom was built up on the Great Lakes in Wisconsin by a builder who primarily builds ships that operate in fresh water, correct?
That's right. And a lot of the corrosion that was, as it turned out, I mean, this was not clear at the time, but through some series of stories that we put out and everything, a lot of the corrosion was inside, going into the main part of the engine room and stuff like that, and had a lot to do with leaks that had developed through some of the piping in our systems.
All right, so here we are. It's a couple years ago, and Mike Fabey has just been appointed naval editor at Aviation Week. You've done some nice work on writing about the Aegis program and the radar systems. You've made your bones. You've irritated a few people. How do you get started on this story, and how does it begin for you and Aviation Week, this journey to the Tim White Award?
What happened was, it was almost about 2 years ago, right about this time, and I received a call from the folks at POGO, Project and Government Oversight. I had worked with POGO on a few other different things before. When I say worked with, I mean, as you know, when you get into this kind of thing, there's a lot of trick flow going on, you know, a lot of trading of information on stories that either you both work on, you help each other, or in some cases, stuff that, you know, you don't want or can't handle and the others can, and so you pass some tips along that nature. The folks at POGO called, said they had some interesting documents regarding LCS, and I should take a look because it was just outside their bailiwick. And so, you know, the typical, okay, let's meet for lunch someplace, and they pushed aside in front of me some documents that were classified, but not classified secret. It was classified for priority reasons. Documents regarding the cracking on Freedom and the corrosion aspects on Freedom that went well beyond what the Navy had publicly acknowledged at that time.
Okay, Mike, we have a call real quick. Let's see if we can take it. Hello, you're on the air with Military Monday.
Hi.
Yes, what's your question?
My question to Michael is this. When you're doing stuff like this, does it ever occur to you to follow the money? Because, like, in the Osprey debacle, where they're still having problems, you know, the Marines are basically calling them flying coffins, there's a lot of political pressure and a lot of money involved and a lot of my district involved and a lot of this, that, and the other thing. Can you look into that? Was that a big part of his investigation? And what did he find if he did?
All right. Thank you very much. We're going to let Mike respond to you, and thank you for calling in.
Thank you.
And, Mike, what's your answer to that?
Yeah, there's an old Spartan saying that says money is the sinews of any great undertaking, and especially true in the military world. With these programs, what I did was because the way that the Navy is going to fund all the repair overall and related work with the problems we're finding with the ships was through contracts and contract modifications. So on one hand, you can go online rather quickly and get a pretty good listing of some of the contract modifications. But also what I've done was I requested, and I've found a fine FOIA for this, for every contract modification related to the LCS pictures. And I also reached out, I know of a couple of other groups that keep quite close tabs, not only on current contract, but expecting contract. And I was able to put together some pretty significant spreadsheets that laid out the kind of a financial history snapshot, current snapshot, and kind of future perspectives for the LCS programs that actually became very helpful and became a pretty significant part of one of our first main battery stories. So that's an important point. I'd say you always want to follow the money. And one of the questions I'd always ask is, whenever they said there was this repair and that repair, is, well, how much did it cost? Where's the modification for that?
Another caller, this time email message from a gentleman who is a friend of mine, and I've mentioned to you, Mike Markowitz, is asking, while the 57-millimeter gun is lethal against helicopters, isn't it nearly useless against large vessels or shore targets? In other words, isn't this, by definition, the baseline gun for the LCS really kind of inadequate given the fact it's going to be operating inshore?
That's not the first time a question like that has been raised. And, you know, the lethality or lack of lethality on these ships is something that has been questioned and continues to be questioned, to this day, and I feel will be questioned into the future. So the quick answer is all indications would suggest the way that the way Navy has operated ships thus far, that would definitely be true. The Navy continues to maintain is that they're going to operate these ships in a different way, partly because they say with the CONOPS, they'll take, for example, instead of taking the ships close enough that they're going to face some of the weaponry, closer land, this will send out, the Romeos, to take a look or even armed fire scouts to go out to some things. That's what they're maintaining. Right now, them saying that and a basic set of CONOPS that continues to be revised almost monthly.
And when you say Romeos, you're talking about the manned H-60 helicopters that are
mm-hmm.
Based aboard the ship, and fire scouts, of course, are little drone helicopters that are being used on board Navy vessels at this time. Talk real quick about reaching out. Once you had the basic material from POGO, talk a little bit about reaching out to people who were, I don't like to use the word experts, but subject matter
people know a lot more than me. Let's put it that way.
Say again?
People who know a lot more than me.
Well, people who have got experience in maritime affairs. Talk about some of the people you reached out to, and I'm going to confess that I was one of them. And in all truthfulness, folks, yes, I did support Mike with some analysis and other information regarding shipbuilding and ship engineering. Please go ahead, Mike.
Right, because the first important point I want to make is that a reporter is often only as good as the sources, whether the sources be documents or people. We're the world's best generalist in many ways. But the important thing is to be able to know people, to know which people to go to and trust, and things like that. And that's what happened here. When I got the documents, it was clear. This thing had pictures. It was clear that there were some serious problems aboard that ship. So
was, by the way, the Freedom class prototype,
right.
USS Freedom. This is not
right.
These problems are not necessarily inherent to the General Dynamics entry USS Independence. So let's keep that in
right.
mind.
At this time, the Independence had not even been at the sea the way the Freedom had. So, that was the only ship that they had. But so I took these documents. Now, I had three people in mind that I wanted to go to. One was someone, and to this day I've not named this one person, but there's a couple people I've named, but this is one of them, who was involved with the very early designing of the Freedom and took the dock and staff person. And the other two people were you, John, as well as Norman Palmar, who, quite honestly, is, you know, pretty much the guru of things naval in this country. And what I had to do, though, because of the classification on these documents, they were still classified, and I still didn't want to run, you know, into any problems with releasing classified material. So basically, I retyped the information from the documents. I retyped them, and so that I would not be actually giving the documents themselves out to other people, but rather sharing information from it. It was a fine point, but in talking to some legal people I know and trust, they said it was a valid point. I took those people and said, okay, here's what these documents say. Here's sort of my understanding of it. Is this correct? And what does this mean now? They gave their concise answer that everyone agreed on was that this showed that there were some serious design issues with these ships. They'd have to be redesigned. That's what they said it should. And that was the story that we were running.
Armed with, shall we say, some subject matter expertise and interpretations as well as documents, there comes now the problem of walking into the management at your magazine, Aviation Week, which at the time was owned by McGraw-Hill, since been sold to another company, but you walk upstairs and there's your editor-in-chief and you say, boss, we got a problem and we got a story. How do you sell the beginnings of a series that winds up winning you an award for investigative journalism someday?
Without getting too much into personalities of different editors involved, so I still want to keep a job. I have to say that originally what happened when we had all of this, the media bosses of mine were all pretty much, wow, this has been, we were pretty excited, quite honestly, about what we had, especially since we had the documentation for it. And we were worried about a couple of things. So we didn't run it up the ladder within Aviation Week too high at that point in time. And quite honestly, I would have to say going back, that was a mistake, that what we should have done was run up the ladder to the highest levels of Asia Aviation Week so everyone would be better prepared. And because we were so worried, we were worried about classification issues that the Navy might try to have the stories held back because it was based on classified material. Even though we didn't name the documents per se, the Navy still knew what we were talking about. And we're also, you know, or they could go the other way and also have a mainly press conference on things, you know, which would basically, you know, hey, if you have a scoop, you don't want the world to share it, and they get a press conference kind of to mute it and to basically, you know, put the plug back in the grenade, you know, the pin back in the grenade kind of thing. So what we did was we gave the folks at the Navy and at Lockheed a relatively short period to comment. It turned out to be a couple days. And what we also did to try to make sure that the news that we talked about was I sent over the paragraphs that I had written about what the report said in English so they would know what was coming, as well as what the analyst said in response. Result of that, and there was the other thing that quite honestly was an interesting thing, because you know now with online, you have a lot more room to play with than you did back in just going on print, and we were putting this up online, you know, at the time, and so because we had all this play with it, the decision was made by the bosses to run a story that was just the allegation on one side, and right next to it online, and with a link to it, was the list of what Navy and Lockheed said. After stories came out, several problems arose. One is that the top echelon Aviation Week folks kind of felt like they had been blindsided. And that's why I wish we had, you know, gone to them from the beginning, said, here's what we got, and even give them a chance to read it, you know, say, hey, you know, because the more eyes open it, I'll tell you this from experience, the more eyes, the better. It may take longer to get in, because everyone wants to put their little, you know, fingerprint on it. But at the same time, the people have those positions at publications like that for a reason, and they know a couple of things the editorial-wise to get there.
Okay, we've got another call. Let's take that, and then we'll take a break.
Okay.
This is Military Monday. What's your question?
Good morning. My question, well, I wanted to commend the gentleman for being able to have the courage to stand up and actually mention something of a major discrepancy, because that can be a very serious issue if you don't know how to handle that well. I've been through that before myself at one time. My question is, when you sit there and challenge people, or challenge like the civilian contract and ask the military, did you ever get any serious repercussions for taking the courage to do that?
Yes. I'm going to say, first of all, yes, and we'll be talking more about that. Mike, make your comment on this, and then we'll go to break.
I'll say the juice bits for later, but I was delisted, blacklisted, threatened, you name it. I mean, the folks tried to have me fired, and then later on put me in jail. So there's a whole bunch of things that happened as a result of the reporting on this, and they're bringing up some of the stories.
And we're going to get to that right after this break for a couple of network messages. This is Military Monday on the Right Stream Radio Network.
You're listening to the Right Stream Radio Network, rejoicing in the flow of creativity. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Right Stream and hashtag Right Stream. Thanks for listening to the Right Stream Radio Network.
Tuesday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the Right Stream Radio Network, tune in to host Daria Ann for Right Stream Tuesday. Daria Ann interviews talented authors in a variety of literary genres, from urban fantasy and historical romance to autobiography and science fiction. Right Stream Tuesday celebrates the creativity that flows through every author. It also delves into the all-important publishing and marketing aspects of writing, including the benefits and pitfalls of independent publishing versus traditional publishing, and how to effectively use social media for success. Right Stream Tuesday with Daria Ann, Tuesday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the Right Stream Radio Network.
These are the sounds of someone taking their eyes off the road. Texting while driving is more than distracting. It's dangerous. Do us all a favor. When you're on the road, stay off the phone. A message from CTIA, America's Wireless Companies, and the National Safety Council.
Hi, this is Lisa Tarvis. I'm a metaphysician, board-certified holistic health practitioner, energy healer, intuitive, and the author of the book, Just Believe. I'm also a host on the Right Stream Network. My radio show is called Just Believe and airs every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern. Please stop by my website at www.lisatarvis.com. That's LISATARVES for details on all the services I offer, information on my book, and my radio show. There are many amazing guests and fascinating topics scheduled for the show in the upcoming months. I look forward to connecting with you soon.
And welcome back to Military Monday. Our guest today is my good friend Mike Fabey, the Naval Editor at Aviation Week and Space Technology, talking about his coverage, which has now just won a major investigative journalism award, on the littoral combat ship being built by the Navy. And Mike, so you've fired your initial barrage at the program, at the contractors, at the Navy. You've got your management at least aware that you're engaging in a campaign to tell the story of what we would all agree is a program with some problems at that point, though obviously we didn't have any idea at the time just how much. What happens as soon as that those first couple of stories appear in Aviation Week, and how does it feel to have people coming after you and everybody you've been talking to?
The initial response, the folks at Lockheed demanded a meeting with my management, and they went, I mean, with the idea of basically supporting the stories. The problems that Lockheed brought up, quite honestly, had nothing to do with factual content stories. They just felt that the way stories were presented and that type of thing wasn't fair. That was their big whatever. But they agreed, though, to work with us, if we gathered more information that would, that would add to the story, push it forward, that kind of thing. At the same time, it was made clear around the area, within Navy and within Lockheed circles too, that I was disinvited to a couple of functions. There were a couple of things I was not invited to. So there was a little, at that point, it was a subtle campaign to kind of keep me out of the loop. But when we came back and we got some additional reporting done based on a very a deep throat like source, and we presented some of that to both the Navy and the Lockheed. And at that point in time, the Navy just refused to address it. Lockheed sent back emails to me and the Aviation Week, said they basically would not work with me ever again on any program, which was essentially until I grew up. It was sort of the message that they would just, if I called, my calls would not be answered.
And at the same time, they began an active campaign to go ahead and, shall we say, disavow and discredit your sources, myself included, correct?
Right. Well, we call them the Kraken stories, based on those initial reports. One of the things they tried to say that that both you and Norman Palmar had reasons to be against the company. And even within the naval circles, they're questioning whether how much Norman Quint was in the loop of current things. Even though I know for a fact that Norman is often brought in for consultation at the highest level. So, but that's what they basically were questioning the sourcing. Again, there was never ever any question of the information, the facts. None of that was ever questioned, proven wrong, or anything. They just questioned the sourcing the way we did.
So you're getting heat. Your sources are not being treated nicely. How far did it escalate? I mean, let's just take it to the ultimate point. I mean, later on, this got to the point where because you continued to press the story, because you continued to work with all sorts of sources, including a very deep source, you were threatened with legal action at one point.
Well, here's what happened. We were at the ultimate he said point. Because we had, on one hand, both Lockheed and the Navy saying, all the stuff you have here, we fixed it. It's done. There are no problems here. You're basing it on old, outdated information, everything like that. Meanwhile, we had a deep throat source, so very well connected to program. I'm saying, no, the ship is a mess. It's a danger. It's a hazard. They said this thing should be put up and used as a trainer, not be put back in the water. And at that point in time, we were kind of, in many ways, stuck, except for, and I got to be careful how I word this, but an opportunity arose whereby I could go aboard the ship and tour it for myself and see firsthand the problems. And
now, this is when she's out in San Diego. She's been going through test and evaluation. She's in for some repairs.
She's at the San Diego Graven dock up on blocks. Right.
And let's be very honest. The Navy was not exactly, shall we say, controlling access to this ship. There were a lot of people going in and out of the USS Freedom at that time.
The way it was described to me is that only Disneyland had was a greater attraction. Without getting too far into it, folks were bringing other folks aboard. People from, if I understand, from city were coming aboard. People were going aboard with very little, checks or imbalances as to who was going aboard and when.
So you were able to go aboard with this person, your deep source.
I was aboard the ship, and person was aboard at the same time.
And okay, I got a guided tour of the ship. And what were some of the high points of the tour? What were things that you saw that were disturbing that you took pictures of and documented during this tour?
Okay, just about throughout the ship, all you had were cracked pipe and holes in it. As a result, there was corrosion all throughout the ship. And the corrosion was even worse as you went down to the engine areas. You had all kinds of equipment that was cracked, did not work anymore. Basically, it was rusty and rotting almost. And go out by where the landing area is. It was just completely just rust covered. And there was corrosion everywhere. And one of the more telling things was I went back to, the way that the Freedom operates, they have a stern door that opens up to the sea, basically the two sides, the left and the right, swing open the way you almost put a cabinet, and they close up again. This has allowed the 11-meter rib to be launched right out a ramp fairly quickly. So, that door has to close up, be watertight, because otherwise you're going to slow down the ship, and not only that, but you're going to put the ship off kilter. There was a gap at that stern door that ran across the whole width of the back, we're talking about 25, 30 feet, that I could put my arm up to my forearm through. You could see a shaft of light coming through, and that's one of the things I photographed. I photographed an awful lot of things as I went through all the different equipment.
I should point out to our listeners, if you look on our promo page, you'll see a couple of the photos Mike took, including the photo of that stern door. And Mike, that really was when you published that photo, that kind of changed the narrative just a bit, didn't it?
Well, I'll tell you what really changed the narrative for this came pre-publication. Because I came back from that, and I had the pictures, and I had the firsthand, visual eye on crap that I had seen. And what we decided to do is we put it all in a spreadsheet, which we called basically observation spreadsheet of issues with Freedom. And we sent that spreadsheet to the folks at NAVSEA, which is Naval Sea Systems Command, who at the time was controlling the development of Freedom at that stage of the game. And we also sent it to the folks at Lockheed. And it was the spreadsheet was accompanied by an email message which said at the front, I recently toured the USS Freedom. Now, before going on a tour, and especially before sending that spreadsheet, I had sat down with a group of different lawyers, some in the military, some outside the military, some connected with government, some just private, really smart folks, as well as some people in the military who are very media savvy. I want to get an idea of what I was walking into, what kind of trouble could I get into. And they all agreed that if I was found on the ship, unless I want to give up my source, I could be obviously charged trespassing, maybe. But the bigger problem was that if by going to certain areas, taking notes of that, and certainly taking pictures of it, let alone publishing them, that I could run afoul of Espionage Act. So we had to be very careful about what we even said we saw, let alone what we published that we said we saw. And that's at that point in time when I sent the letter out saying we had recently toured your ship is when That's before even the publication. That's when the threat started coming in, and some other even more weird things.
Now, let us say for the record that you're a Philly boy.
Yeah.
And people from Philadelphia have a known attitude, especially the journalists from there. It's, shall we say, a bit of street toughness. At this point in time, are you thinking, maybe I ought to walk away from this, or is this a put your head down and run through the wall moment?
This was a put your head down and run through the mall, run through the wall moment, but not because, you know, of a sense of journalistic right or wrong. There was that, some of that played into it, but I was really, really upset by what I saw, because our source had been right on top of this. I mean, this was a risky environment to be putting our sailors in. And we really, really, that's what was the drive. From that moment on, it was the driving thing of, we have to get this out there, because no matter what, people have to be made aware of this. If we didn't do if I knew everything I did to get it out past then, and something happened to that ship, I would be just as culpable as everyone else.
And again, let's make it clear, we're talking about the Freedom class ship, not the Independence class, which at this point had the usual kinds of new first ship of class problems, but had generally gotten through operational tests and was working hard to go ahead and validate the various bits and pieces of the mine hunting module. So this is just USS Freedom, okay?
Right.
So when does it change? When do you suddenly start feeling you and the story are getting traction, and that you're starting to win this fight?
There was a serious test. Right after they got our observation sheet, when first the threats came, it got worse before it got better. And the worst part came, first had a call from someone, I won't identify, but they identified themselves, but an officer in the Navy who told me that they didn't care what my questions were. They quite honestly, all they wanted to do was see both me and my source prosecute the full thing of the law. After that came a very odd phone call by someone from the San Diego Airport Security Office, and I checked, of course, there is no such thing. Saying they had found a piece of paper on the floor with my name on it from a couple weeks ago. They wanted to see if I had been through that airport recently. Obviously this was an effort to triangulate my actions and everything like that. And the odd thing was I never was in San Diego Airport. But so there was some of that. And then right before we published it also, conversation between my bosses and some of the higher elements within the Navy shipbuilding community said if we published some of our pictures, well, actually said they published our pictures, then they were going to have me locked up. So we came out, we published, and what happened after that was that on the contractor side and the Navy side, I was persona non grata. And and even more to the point is, because we already gone, I, in order to make sure the right people saw this, and by right people, I mean, in this country, the right people are members of Congress, quite honestly. Because they're the people with the money. So we had gone...
Well, certainly the people who allocate the money, yes.
Right. So we had gone to certain staffers and certain folks that we knew might care about this, and we had shared all the pictures with them, and as well as some additional information that we now include in the story and everything like that. So, and basically, by the time the story came out, our next day follow was legislation that was approved, demanding GAO reports and things like that. So, what happened, the contractor and the Navy folks realized that they had now in Congress against our reporting. And so it quickly became known to me that what they were doing was they were saying, oh, look, You know, we have no idea when Fabi was on that ship. This could have been a year ago, because the only picture we had shown was on the stern gap, you know, so which didn't, that picture alone doesn't identify, you know, a sense of time element about it. And so they were basically, and this was getting some traction, was, again, this is old material. They're just publishing now as new. It's not, it does, it's not true anymore. You know, they're basically saying we're making this up. You know, that's sort of what they were saying. So,
and then, of course, you're able to provide additional reporting on
right.
a rather notorious incident, which we call the 500-gallon-a-minute leak. Now, you got cell phone video on a main water connection down in the engineering room of Freedom.
Let's put it this way. I have absolute proof of what happened. I can't say what.
And this is a major connection. And to give people an idea, 500 gallons of water being dumped into the engine room of any ship, that's 2 tons of water coming on board every minute. And about 15 minutes of that, and you're going to capsize a ship the size of Freedom. And that's a pretty disturbing piece of video. And there's no hiding the incident. There were too many people who were witnesses to it, right?
Well, there were certainly a lot of witnesses there, but again, all I can say is that I have proof positive that much water was being dumped in there. Lainey was trying to say it was basically a showerhead leak, but I have absolute 100% pure evidence of what actually happened. There was that incident, but also two other things that were, you know, I think equally as telling. One is we ran another picture of the ship up at the in the Graven dock, up on the blocks, and it's a pretty that spot. There are very few like it. I mean, that Freedom had been in. So putting that picture out there showed it pretty much exactly when we had been there. And then the other thing was a story about a group of emails, because and I can't say how I got this, but I gotten some rather large amount of data off the ship, including a large amount of emails connected with the ship, including an exchange that basically was from Navy officials telling subordinates above on the ship to hide negative information about testing on that ship, because they were afraid of contractor backlash and what would happen to the down select. And this was in December of 2010, and basically what happened about 2 weeks later or so was that the Navy instead went and said, both ships are just doing great. We got this fantastic offer now from both contractors, but it's a limited time. You've got to buy now. If you do, we're going to get this great black buy for wonderful ships for a significant savings. And that's what happened.
So it's getting to be 2012, and the story's turning around because you're starting to get people in the Navy who are starting to realize that your story's got traction. There's criticism coming in from Congress, from POGO, from other media, and the Navy suddenly makes a decision to take management of the LCS program away from the typical program executive office and give it to something called the LCS Council. What kind of a change for you was that, and what were the side effects of it?
I'll tell you, it was 180 doesn't even begin to describe it. It's almost like being on one of those roller coaster rides that stop midstream and go backwards. That's exactly what this is, because they just one of the folks called me in over to CHINFO office, the chief of information for Navy, and said, you know, sat me down and said, all right, look, I'm going to talk to you off the record about this. And what they said was they acknowledged that my reporting was on the mark, that they apologized for not only, you know, trying to say it wasn't, but, you know, kind of, you know, allowing the bad information to get out there, as well as the relationships to go as bad as they did. They said that they would go back to my questions from my tour to ship and answer them. They said they would make it available to sit down for all the major admirals who were involved with fixing the LCS program, including the one that was now in charge of that, the LCS Council, who was Admiral Hunt at the time. And then finally they said, and tell you what, you know, we're doing this because, you know, you've come to voice opposition free. We think we fixed the ship now. And they said, in no small part because of the reporting. And we went, and no one's going to believe us unless, you know, that reporting comes from you now. And so they offered me back on the ship during certification trials to show how it had been fixed. And so it was just an amazing turn of events. I've never seen an institution like the U.S. Navy.
And I think here that we both would agree there is a gentleman whose name needs to be mentioned in the most positive light possible. This is Rear Admiral Kirby, who had become
Absolutely.
The Chief of Navy Information during this period of time. And this is a gentleman who, I'm going to let you describe him in further detail, but right now he's kind of the poster child for transparency in the Department of Defense.
Well, he was the one who basically set in motion not only everything that happened then in terms of changing the way that folks responded to me and making information available for me, but even after that, he continued, no matter what was going on with that program, he continued to push for it to be made as transparent as possible. And I remember, you know, during, this was right as the, you know, this was after the meeting I had with the folks at Chinfo that had brought me in to talk about how they wanted to change the relationship. But it was before the Chinfo folks had actually made good on their promises. And mind you, we still had a ton of information we had not, quite honestly, I think might have sunk the whole LCS program, some of the material that we had. And if the Stonewall had continued and we reported the way that probably, you know, we would have, I mean, and given everything that's happened, there was no reason not to, because, you know, that at that point in time, Navy officially was still denying everything. And I ran to Admiral Kirby at one of the an event, one of these breakfasts where they had a bunch of flag officers talking, and he came to me and he said, you know, he agreed with himself, and he said, I wish we had had your reporting earlier. And being from Philly, I'm used to sarcasm. I thought he was being sarcastic. And I said, wait, being sarcastic? He said, not at all. He said, we wouldn't have gotten as much trouble as we all got into if we had. And he said, the truth of the matter is, we need that kind of transparency. Wish we'd had it. We're going to make sure that's what we get from now on. And he made good on that in a huge way.
After you fell off your wombat and dusted yourself off, I'm sure it became patently obvious this was that there was a new wind blowing, not just through the halls of the Navy, but through the Pentagon, at least where your reporting was going. Talk a little bit about the end game, how this has gone, because you got the opportunity to follow USS Freedom on her first deployment out to Singapore, which certainly on the way out was not a happy thing, but you got to see certainly some of the good parts in the middle and on the way home. Talk a little bit about her deployment. Just take 5 minutes and tell us how it went and where the ship is today.
Sure. I mean, the way out, I mean, you know, Freedom had the same exact problems that it's been having all along. It's been having problems with its generators going dark and losing power. It's been having problems with its coolers. You know, these are problems that they've had all along. It has a lot to do with some design issues and some equipment issues. And now basically said, we think we've got the fixes, and those fixes are going to be front-fitted for the next group of ships and back-fitted in Freedom later. And made it out to Singapore. Let's just say the up-tempo, the, you know, amount of time that was available, was right around 40%. The Navy is been arguing, well, look, we went out there, we made a majority of our events, we're happy with that, we proved the, you know, concept, and we come back. You know, other folks in and out of Congress and among defense circles don't feel that 40% is all that great, you know, especially given the problems I had. It made it back from Singapore back into Hawaii, at least, well, actually, all the way back to San Diego, with no problems. And the command officer at the time, Commander Thien, I joined the ship just in the Pacific as it was approaching Pearl, and he was running that ship at high speeds on just using the diesels. And he told me, I asked him, did you baby the ship? I don't baby anything. So coming back, the ship had a much better trek than going out. And then it's now back in, it made back to San Diego. It is due for some overhaul work. And after that, it's going to join some of the testing community and probably get ready in the next couple of years or so or less for another Western Pacific deployment.
And her sister ship, USS Fort Worth, is going to make the next deployment later this year, correct?
Right. It's going to, they originally supposed to be in the spring. They're going to hold off on that ship. Part of it is to make some more modifications based on the Freedom deployment. And part of that is because they want to hold off. They want to put some different pieces out there involving Fort Worth and involving some other naval assets, and including they're going to put a fire scout aboard, too, on this deployment. So they want to keep it out there. They're going to send out later with some more modifications, a better idea of the CONOPS, or so they say, and they're going to have more pieces out there as part of the surface warfare package. They still don't have that air-to-air missile they want. I mean, the surface-air missile they want. But, they're willing to, they don't need it. It's not due anyway for another couple of years is their point. So they're going to deploy that ship without the vessel for the surface program.
So you won. I mean, by any standard of investigative journalism, you won the argument. What do your bosses think of you now? I mean, you obviously took them on a journey through the dark side of military journalism, and you've come out the other side. How do they feel about you right now?
Until the award, I would say still, they have respect for what I've done. At the same time, they kind of we're still wondering, so where does it all take us? And now that's becoming a lot more clear. I think there's also a sense of I don't get questioned on my work as much now, but it's one of these things where, especially after some of the very initial reporting of this, after that, there was definitely a sense of my work being scrutinized, shall we say. And I think now there's much more of a sense of, it's good, solid stuff. At the time, when you first come out there and everyone's taking shots at you, and, you have proof, but not all the proof, and certainly they were getting a lot of pressure, from, a top defense contractor, when you're in the the magazine, in a world like that, especially this magazine, that's a lot to kind of endure.
And let's talk a little about the award. The Timothy White Award isn't given every year. It's not an annual award. It's given on an as-deserved basis for people who've put up with an extraordinary level of crap doing the job of journalism. When did you know that you were going to be nominated for this, and when did you find out about it officially?
I knew I was going to be nominated when I was out by Pearl, about to fly out to get it to the heel ride out to freedom, because my immediate boss said, "We want to put in for this award. Do you happen to have your stories in digital form, and a kind of like a synopsis of how you did the story and everything?" So I kind of put some things together as quick as I could, sending it out from there before taking off and going out to freedom, and they took it and put it into actually a more readable form and everything like that. And we just they announced it officially this past week. We knew a little bit before, not much, but just a little bit beforehand that we had won.
And what does it feel like to win this award? I mean, this is obviously, in terms of, prestige within the community, this is very much like winning a Pulitzer Prize, which, of course, none of the Pulitzers cover the kind of writing that you do. So how does this feel to you? I mean, what's going through your brain as you get the news on this?
Well, on one hand, it doesn't change the reporting. In other words, before I won the award, I had still done the reporting. I had still, did the work. I had still did something that I think in the end, made life better for most important people we have out there, our sailors. So in that part of it, the Lord's good work had already been done. But at the same time, there was certainly, a sense of, it'd be nice if this was more recognized, and not so much me being recognized. I mean, we all like that, but more importantly, this kind of work being recognized, because I think what's happening today, to be honest, is there's, because of all the different kinds of media we have out there, there is so much more of an emphasis on the glitzy and the pretty, if you know what I mean. We got to make it look nice and everything like that. There's definitely less emphasis on work that has impact, that makes a difference. And I think that's the role of the sailors, but that's the other winner here, is that, here is something that, that acknowledges work that made a difference. That I really believe is sort of the reason for journalism in the first place.
There's a flip side to this, which is, Washington, D.C. is a place where if you're a journalist like you and I, you are judged, valued, and otherwise, totemed in a lot of cases by the enemies you keep and the notches in your gun. Some years ago, I had this pleasure of sitting down with Tom Wicker and Bob Woodward and some other people at an author's night over at the National Press Club in town. And somebody asked Woodward what it was like to be able to have the reputation of having killed a president and a presidency back in the 1970s when he was just, a kid. He was not that old at the time. And he was musing to all of us that it was a heavy responsibility, and I think he said what bothered him at the time was that everybody expected him to do it again and again and again. And stories like this don't happen every day. They're sometimes a once in a lifetime occurrence. Now you've got that badass that badass bully reputation to some degree of having been a journalist who has done an amazing thing, who has been recognized for it. What does that mean to you now? I mean, how does it change your outlook, and what kind of a burden or responsibility is it for you to carry around for the rest of your life?
I don't know about burden. I would say there definitely is a responsibility, but the one thing which I do feel it gives me is sort of a, I can take a much more measured approach to things. If you, for example, before I was more likely to really get in someone's face, you know, that kind of the old Philly style journalism we just talked about, you know, which I learned covering dock workers, you know, and when I was at the business journal there kind of thing. But now I can be much more understated in my approach because they already know now the kind of stuff that not only I'm capable of doing, you know, but that our publication is willing to publish. You know, that's a twofer. You've got to have someone willing to put it out there as well as you're willing and capable of doing it. So now they know what we can and will do. And so, you know, I can be a lot – I don't have to be this overly aggressive, threatening kind of persona. I can be a lot more just laid back about it and sort of say, look, you know, if we – you know, we – you know, this information, once this information, we don't get this information, there are other ways to get. And that's the other thing, too, is that one of the things I found out from the Freedom thing is I won't say who, but I was going to interview an admiral about a couple things. And we're walking in and to do the interview. He goes, oh, by the way, I'm sure you already heard about this one particular thing that was involved in Freedom. And I hadn't heard, but the assumption was I already had heard. The assumption was I already knew it. And so I think part of what's happening here, this whole transparency thing, is a feeling now, oh, well, they already know. You know, they must know already because the source was so good before, you know, and at some point in time that will kind of, you know, that could start going back. I guess it depends on a few things, who takes over as the chief of naval information, for example, that will follow through. But for right now, There's a sense of, you know, don't we have to make a simple request now? The information is starting to flow, as it should. I mean, these people, I also do think that these people have seen what they saw at the end of the coverage of this was that they had a better chance to control the narrative. Because if they worked with me and, you know, and with getting the work, the actual truth out about this, that the headlines would be much more muted. There would be no more screaming headlines because we didn't have to dig it up anymore. Now it's they acknowledging it and saying, here's what we're going to do. And to be fair, you know, it's much more important to say, oh, well, here's what they're going to do because that's pushing the story forward. And I think they see the benefit now of being more transparent. So.
Mike, it's time for us to wrap this up, but I want to thank you for coming on. I also want to thank you because myself and other journalists who work around the same community are already seeing more access, more transparency, and frankly, a much more positive attitude to the work we do. Thank you for going and rubbing off on the rest of us. I look forward to you getting your prize and putting it up on the mantelpiece. God bless you, and I hope we can have you on the show again sometime soon.
I'd love to. Thanks for having me, John, and well, you know, thanks for your kind words. But as you pointed out earlier, I mean, you're one of the folks that helped put me down that path, so you get to share the fame and the blame. But thanks all
around. Well, I'll take my share of both, Lord knows. Thank you very much. Have a great afternoon.
You too. All the best.
And then with that, we've come to the end of another Military Monday show. Please join us again next week at 1 p.m. Eastern Time when we will have Bob Doerr on to go and talk about the 75th anniversary of the 8th Air Force and their Big Week mini campaign during World War II, in particular, the first U.S. missions to Berlin. Take care. Be well.